Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Acil Ford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, Michael Glenn, Elizabeth Demery, James Konacek, Karen Carbone, James Lewis, Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, Johann Detweiler, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 80, Sunspot.
Ryan Cotter stood out of the line of fire, his back pressed against a mud brick wall. The ground was partially frozen underfoot in the ramshackle hilltop maze of Redboneville. A makeshift barricade of rocks and dirt stood less than 100 feet from Ryan's position. It blocked the entrance to a path that was the Ville's only remaining escape route. The muzzles of three AK-47s poked out through firing ports, gaps in the layers of piled debris. With black powder revolvers and remade single-shot 12-gauges, Redbone's trapped residents fought off a superior force. Time was running out for all concerned. Ryan stepped from cover, his scoped Steyr SSG-70 slung over his shoulder, a Sig Sauer P226 securely holstered under his left armpit. With empty hands in plain view, he advanced up the path. The worn AK sights held steady on his chest as he closed the distance, looking straight into the maw of a firing squad. 50 feet. 40 feet. The adrenaline coursing through his veins made his fingertips tingle and his scalp crawl. The sensation spread along the jagged welt of scar that split his brow and cheek. He kept his hands in sight, well away from his body.
Stop there!
Ryan kept walking, spreading his arms wide, displaying open palms and a gesture of surrender.
Stop or you're dead!
Ryan was betting they wouldn't shoot unless he made a move for his weapons. Baron Melage paid his press gangs by the head. The live head. This crew's job was to capture or to turn back any Ville folk trying to escape conscription into the Baron's army. To Melage, even a one-eyed man had value, if only as cannon fodder.
Stop!
I give up. You win. Take my weapons.
Get on your belly! Now!
No way I'm gonna lie face down in the pig shit. I said you could take my blasters.
Ryan was 5 yards from the barricade when the Baron's men realized that the closer he came, the more he blocked their view and their ability to control the entire kill zone. To see around him, to see what was coming directly behind him, they had to move to the side and stand from cover. This they did, more or less in unison. Ryan dived to the dirt in front of the barrier, leaving them exposed to incoming fire. Ryan pushed up from the ground and, drawing his Sig from shoulder leather, vaulted the barricade. He found himself in a tight, shanty-lined lane. All three of Malash's men were down. Ryan raised his weapon and surveyed the alley. On either side of the dirt lane, a dozen one-room shanties shared common earthen walls and corrugated metal roofs. The crooked, doorless entryways faced one another, raising the possibility of a nasty close-range crossfire. Through the gap at the far end of the alley, Ryan saw distant blue mountains bathed in bright sunlight beyond the edge of the coming storm. For generations, the area's farmers had retreated to higher ground for their common defense. The fortified Ville had easily held off bands of predatory muties and cold-heart robbers. Against a large, well-trained and equipped military force, however, Redbone was a sitting duck. Ryan took a quick glance over his shoulder to check on his companions, who were charging toward him. Jack Lauren ran in front in long, loping strides, his .357 Magnum Colt Python in his fist. Jack's face was bloodlessly white. His long, lank, platinum hair streamed back from his head. As the albino ran, his ruby-red eyes scanned the doorways and rooftops of the wall-to-wall huts for enemy snipers. Following hard on his heels was John Barrymore Dix. The bespectacled armorer gripped his Uzi machine pistol in both hands. His shoulder-slung Smith & Wesson M4000 12-gauge pump slept wildly against his back. His prized fedora was screwed down on his head to keep it from blowing off. Behind JB were two women with revolvers drawn, running shoulder to shoulder. In a shaggy fur coat and western-style boots was tall, red-haired Christy Roth, Ryan's longtime lover and soulmate. By her side, the short black woman in a patched mil-spec parka was Dr. Mildred Wyeth, whom Ryan and the others had awakened from a 100-year cryosleep. Both women carried .38 caliber weapons. Christy's weapon of choice was a Smith & Wesson 640. Mildred's was a Checkmate ZKR 551. Bringing up the rear of the formation, the tails of his waistcoat flapping as he sprinted in cracked knee boots, was Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner. White coats from ultra-secret Operation Kronos had trawled him forward from the year 1896 to 1998, ripping him from his life in Omaha, Nebraska. In isolated laboratories, researchers had experimented on him for long months, and then they had hurled him blindly into the future. This to rid themselves of his truculent Victorian carcass and as payback for his lack of cooperation. He had been transported 90-some years forward in time to hell. In his left hand, Doc carried a silver-handled ebony sword stick, which counterbalanced the considerable mass and weight of the firearm he held in his other hand. The Black Powder Lama was a relic. Its 5.5-inch top barrel fired 44 caliber lead balls from its revolver cylinder. Behind Doc, Ryan saw black smoke begin to pour from the roofs of the jumble of low buildings at the center of the ville. The Baron's press gangs were burning out Redboneville's draft resistors. As he turned back to the alley, a short man leaned out of a doorway on the right, an AK shouldered and ready to rip. Ryan didn't pause to verify allegiance or intent. The man fell back through the doorway, dropping the AK across the threshold as he went down.
Help! Please!
Help! Help us!
Ryan stood his ground, covering the lane until his companions had joined him. Ryan signaled for Jack, Christy, and Doc to continue sweeping the alley for more of Malosh's crew. He stepped over the body and entered the hut, with JB and Mildred behind him. The low-ceilinged gloom reeked of fear and pig muck. Five people sat on the earthen floor, their hands tied behind their backs, their knees drawn up, their ankles bound together. Two of the men and the sole female were in their late teens or early 20s, dressed in homespun cloth. The other two male captives were trussed back to back. Their clothes were layers of filthy rags. One was in his late 50s with a deeply weather-seamed and pitted face and wild salt-and-pepper hair and whiskers. The man tied to him was less than half his age and half again his size, bootless, barrel-chested, his patterned bald hair shaved to stubble, with an oddly smooth and doughy baby face.
Cut us free! We're Redbone folk, born and bred. We're on the same side as you, otherwise we wouldn't be tied up like this.
If you don't let us go, Baron Malosh will force us to fight his stinking wars. Free us, and we'll fight against him, here and now.
We'll take back our vill.
Ryan gave the young woman a dubious look, but unsheathed his panga, and with deft strokes, severed all their bonds.
You know you can't possibly win. Come with us, away from here.
We won't abandon our land. Our kin have been here since Nuke Day.
We don't have time to argue with you. You can do as you please.
The young woman snatched up the AK from the threshold.
If you fight alongside us, we have a chance.
Not our vill.
There are three more AKs outside. You can hold off the Baron's gang from behind the barricade. Wait until they get close before you open fire.
Ryan spoke the last words to the trio's backs as they rushed out the door.
What about you two? Are you staying to fight?
The fight's already lost. If we stay, the Baron's men will catch us. We'll take our chances with you.
What are your names?
He's Crad, and I'm Bezawar.
This is going to be a foot race. No telling how far we're going to have to run to get clear of Malosh. If you can't keep up with us, you'll get left behind. We won't let you slow us down, and we won't risk our lives to save yours. You understand?
Bezawar nodded, grimacing at the news. The grizzle-bearded man pushed his large friend out into the alley, ahead of Ryan and the others. When Crad saw the dead black and white hog lying in the lane, he broke free of the smaller man's grip. He raced to the side of the gutshot animal and dropped to his knees.
Oh!
Bezoar ran to catch him, limping hard on a right leg that didn't bend at all at the knee.
She's gone, boy. It's a nuke in pity and a rad blasted waste. But there's nothing more we can do for the old girl. Buck up now, we gotta go.
Move!
Piggy dear. Piggy dear.
Bezoar grabbed his friend by the shoulders and gently but firmly dragged him from the corpse.
A gimp and a triple stoop drooly. They aren't gonna last half a mile, Ryan.
I reckon it's their choice where they want to die.
Jack, Christy, and Doc waited at the far end of the lane. The Redbone folk they'd rescued were already manning the barricade, covering their rear with the captured pre-dark assault rifles. The other hovels were deserted. Just beyond the last of the tumble-down dwellings, the alley ended abruptly at the edge of a nearly sheer 300-foot cliff. Redboneville was laid out like a medieval castle town. The ville's buildings clung to and jutted up from the hilltop, extensions of the vertical bedrock. There was no sign of a rear guard on the plain. Christy took in the two unarmed swineherds, then looked at Ryan with concern. Her prehensile muti hair had already drawn into tight curls, an automatic response to the mortal danger they faced.
They know their excess baggage. Let's get out of here.
Jack jumped out onto the trail and led the rapid descent. As the companions skidded single file to the bottom, bolts of lightning shot through the northwestern sky, that had turned black as night. It was at least 20 degrees warmer down on the plain, and the wind had acquired a strange, unpleasantly humid edge.
Could be a chem storm. A bad one.
It's going to come down on us hard.
And shortly, it would appear. Perhaps we should consider seeking shelter until it passes.
No time for that now. We have to get out of Long Blaster range before the Baron's men spot us and pin us down. You take the point, Jack. Cut through the fields, then follow cover to the southeast, away from the storm front. Double time it. No stops.
With the albino in the lead, they broke from the base of the hill and ran into the rows of cabbages and knee-high potato plants. There were no farmers' bodies lying about. Malash's army had closed in during the night and had attacked at first light. The barricaded alley had fallen, and with it, Redboneville. Jack picked up the pace. Ryan and the others matched it. The desert hardpan was much easier to run on than the soft, cultivated earth. Jack led them down into a shallow gully, and they followed it, running as low to the ground as they could. The ditch wasn't deep enough to completely conceal them. The chaparral and scrub along its lip broke up and blurred their silhouettes. They drew no sniper fire from the ville, either because they hadn't been seen, or because they were already out of range. The discomforts of the forced march were all too familiar to them. The bonfires burning in lungs and legs, the jarring impacts on hip joints and knees. The two swineherds managed to keep up, so far. 14 hours ago, on the previous evening, the companions had arrived in Redbone after a long trek south. They had planned on trading part of their stock of bullets for food and water. Instead, they had had to expend them making their escape. None of them had any first-hand knowledge of Baron Malash. If a tenth of the gossip the companions had heard about Malash was true, he was an utterly ruthless marauder and a formidable adversary. It was said that he had carved a kingdom out of nothing. His own homeland was poor, with little water and fertile soil, barely able to support its population. Malash kept his ragtag army in constant motion, resupplying it through looting and pillage, replacing dead fighters with conscripts. Norms and muties, male and female. When he conquered a ville like Redbone, he took away most of the food and most of the able-bodied residents. He always left behind a little to eat and a few breeders, and of course, the old folk and very young children, useless in battle. He left sufficient living souls and resources for the ville to eventually recover, albeit with terrible hardship. This, so he could prey on it again when the need arose. The gully widened as it emptied into a much broader channel. The dry riverbed was cut with deep rills and dotted with scrub-covered islands. Jack took them along the near bank, an undercut bluff 6 feet high. Ryan brought up the rear, running in grim silence, conserving his energy. He could sense the storm front rapidly overtaking them. The static charge in the air made the hair on his arms and neck stand erect. The smell of ozone grew thicker and thicker. They were about a mile from the Ville when he halted the column's advance.
Time for a quick recon to check for pursuit.
He waved for JB to follow, then started to climb up the side of the bluff, using exposed roots and embedded rocks as hand and footholds.
Maybe they won't come after us?
If they saw us running away, they're coming. 8 live recruits are worth plenty to Milosh. Not to mention him wanting payback for the men we chilled.
When he was on his feet again, raindrops fell on Ryan's face and hands. The drops felt tepid and slightly greasy. They didn't burn like holy nuke fire. It wasn't the caustic, flesh-melting variety of chem rain. JB pulled out a battered pair of compact binocs and looked back toward Redbone.
Men on horseback, coming down a cliff trail. Pack of dogs running with them.
Let me have a look-see.
Here. I counted a half dozen horsemen.
There's twice that many dogs. Big ones.
By the 3 Kennedys, it's a fox hunt. The dogs will pick up our scent and the horses will run us to ground in no time.
Ryan turned the binocs to the northwest horizon. Below the cloud bank, a torrential downpour obscured his view of the plain.
Heavy rain is bearing down. It'll cover our footprints and wash away our scent.
Baron's men can see that too. They're going to come at a dead gallop.
We're in a floodplain here. We need to find ourselves some higher ground.
As Ryan and JB scrambled from the bluff, Jack waved the others after him and headed down channel. Bezawar was the only one who didn't move to follow. The old swineherd sat slumped on the rock, his bad legs sticking out straight, his face still deep red. Brad turned back to help him get to his feet.
It's no use, boy. I can't run anymore. You go on without me. Save yourself.
I go. You go.
Brad bent and picked up his comrade, Piggyback. Then, as if the added burden was nothing, he broke into a trot, following Jack.
That one's something special.
Short on words and brains, maybe, but long on heart.
Truly sure can run.
Better catch up to them.
No matter how hard the rain came down, Ryan knew they couldn't stop to wait out the storm, even if the trail they left behind was obscured. The only thing that was going to save them from the pursuit was distance. Only if the dogs and horses couldn't recover the lost trail were they home free. Ryan looked over his shoulder, squinting into the wind and the looming darkness. In a strobe flash of lightning, he saw the approaching squall line, like a vast waterfall stretching across the plain from edge to edge. The ground turned to oatmeal underfoot. Ryan veered and jumped the barrier, splashing down knee-deep in a muddy, coffee and cream-colored pool. The runoff was funneling from high ground below. Ahead, shallow stream channels filled and overflowed, coalescing into broad stretches of shin-high rapids. When Ryan looked back again, through the shifting downpour, he saw the dogs, drop-jawed, lolling tongues, legs driving, splashing through the stream. Behind the hellhounds, torrents of water sheeted over the backs of charging horses and riders.
Up, Jack!
Jack was already doing just that. Because the crumbling bank on the right would never have held the companion's weight, he led them in the opposite direction, to the crest of a teardrop-shaped, scrub-covered island, high ground where they could make a stand. As Ryan high-stepped through the boot-sucking muck of the island's beach, he half-turned. Surging up behind the dogs and horses was a foaming wall of milky brown water 10 feet high.
Hang on to something!
As Ryan grabbed hold of the branches of a low bush, a flash flood slammed into the mounted pursuit. The force of the wave and its load of debris bowled over the horses and riders. It swept away the dogs in an instant. For a split second, Ryan glimpsed the head of a horse as it bobbed up, rushing past, its eyes wild with fear. Then it disappeared under the churning surface. The one-eyed man used the scrub limbs to pull himself to higher ground, where his companion stood. Ryan jammed his boots against the roots of the brush to help hold his position.
What happened to the pursuit?
Long gone.
The water level is still rising. It appears we've departed the frying pan only to land squarely in the fire.
Their little mound of safety was growing smaller and smaller by the minute. The river flowed around their knees. Ryan could feel the ground eroding from underfoot.
What are we gonna do?
Christy looked across the mocha-colored river.
Too strong a current to swim through. We'd never make it back to the bank.
Only thing we can do is wait it out. Hang on and hope we don't get washed loose before the river starts to fall.
After a while, the torrential rain stopped, but the river continued to come up. Soon it even submerged most of the brush on the island's crest. Clustered together, the companions grasped the ends of the branches, half swimming at times, their legs dangling back in the flow.
Over there!
Ryan looked up to see a row of weak yellow lights bobbing toward them along the bank.
Surrender, or be swept away!
Milosh had come to their rescue. Under the circumstances, the companions couldn't reach for or raise their weapons.
We could let the current take us downstream, maybe get past them.
The odds of running those rapids and surviving to tell the tale are slim at best, my dear.
Too many downed trees in the flow. We'd get snagged and never come up.
Drowning doesn't suit me.
We could die now without firing a shot, or we can try to live long enough to fight at a time and place of our choosing.
Proposed in that way, it is an easy decision to make. There is only one acceptable course of action.
We all agreed then? Is anyone opposed?
We give up!
We'll throw you a rope! Make it fast at your end!
JB managed to trap and tie off the line, lashing it around the submerged trunk of a stunted but sturdily rooted tree. One by one, the companions used the rope to pull themselves hand over hand through the chest-high current to the light of the lanterns. Ryan was the last to ford the swollen river. As he climbed out of the water, a horseman approached. Black-gloved hands held the reins of the towering chestnut stallion. The rider was dressed in a gleaming black rain cape. Covering the lower half of his face was a leather mask. An oval of metal mesh in front of his mouth allowed him to speak unmuffled. There were angry boils and sores on his high, pale forehead. The eyes above the mask were black and wide-set. His shoulder-length, wavy black hair lay plastered to his head by the rain. There was no mistaking Milosh the Impaler. A tall, broad figure in an olive-drab trench coat climbed the steep, barren approach to the base of the rabbit-ear spires. The gusting wind beat his BDU pants hard against his legs. His head was shaven except for a fringe of dirty blonde hair that fell back from the back of his neck to between his shoulder blades. A wide, black-tattooed garland encircled his deeply suntanned skull. The permanent crown symbolized his authority. Kendrick Haldane had been declared baron for life by a grateful populace. In the valley far below, the grandee glistened in the slanting sun like a fat green snake. Baron Haldane controlled nearly 100 miles of riverbank, with watchtowers and small fortifications set on cliffs above the stream and from bankside caves. In return for a guarantee of safety, every farmer, every traveler, every trader paid the Baron a fair toll, either in jack or in a percentage of goods. Nueva Las Cruces, or Nuevaville for short, had been constructed well back from the Grandee's new shoreline. Amid groves of trees and green cultivated fields were clusters of immobile, mobile homes, dilapidated RVs propped on cinder blocks, and tractor trailers with crude windows cut in their sheet metal sides. Two-thirds of the barony's population tilled the land, processed surplus food for storage and sale, or worked on a fleet of transport barges. The rest of Haldane's subjects were full-time men-at-arms. From the towering height of the Rabbit Ear Plateau, his capital looked bucolic and peaceful, as if time had been reversed. It was an illusion, he knew. As Haldane resumed the climb, struggling up a slope that constantly shifted underfoot, he leaned into the wind. In perhaps 2 hours, three at most, the storm would be hard upon them, turning Nuevaville's dirt roads to mire and spilling the river over its banks. Looming above him were the snaggletooth pinnacles of the Organ Mountains. With the wind to his back, he followed a well-worn path along the base of the spires. It led to a broad cave in the bedrock, about 10 feet high at its tallest, and five times that wide across. Inside the low opening were crude structures built of mud and straw bricks. From glassless windows and doorless doorways, rows of faces peered out at him, luminously pale, as round as full moons. He smelled burning excrement, which the cave dwellers dried and used as fuel for heat and for cooking. The filthy hands of three generations of inbred Dumis directed him toward the stone hut that stood a few hundred feet downslope. As was the custom, Baron Haldane left his blaster outside the root sanctuary and slung his Remington Model 1100 12-gauge autoloader. After he carefully set the scattergun on the ground, He pushed aside the brown polyester blanket that covered the hut's doorway, ducking his head to enter. Dim light streamed into the structure through uncountable cracks in the walls. There was no fire lit on the floor, nor candles lit, for fear of igniting the dizzyingly sweet, flammable vapors concentrated therein. On a tripod chair positioned directly over the stone vent, enveloped in lighter-than-air petrochemical perfume, sat the Oracle. The 85-pound Doomie sat with eyes tightly closed. A halo of wispy white hair crowned his knobby skull. Pale skin like parchment hung in folds from under chin and arms. There was no seat for visitors in the close confines of the hut. Haldane stood, slightly bent over, to keep the top of his head from bumping into the crust of chemical deposits on the wooden rafters.
You know why I've come.
A dark deed looms. The noble baron's hands will drip with the blood of slaughtered innocents. You want to know if there's a less brutal way to accomplish the end you desire? Some other possible strategy? Some sequence of events you may have overlooked?
Well, I have to use the terrible weapon I've been offered.
Though all members of the Doomie race had the power to see into the future, the Rock Spring sweet gas greatly stimulated their muty supersense. It also made them very, very happy. Too much perfume, and they swallowed their own tongues and choked to death.
I have looked into your future, Baron. I have seen the struggles ahead. For you, there is no other path.
It was not the answer Haldane wanted to hear. Haldane had always seen himself, and had been seen by his subjects, as a defender and a shepherd, both wise and fair. The course of action that lay before him was wise, but hardly fair. In target, in scale and scope, in moral consequences, this killing was different. Even by Deathland standards, it was the act of a depraved, unfeeling butcher.
There will be so much death.
You alone have the power to put an end to the cycle of terror. You can prevent the deaths of those you hold dear for decades to come.
I am not a mass killer. I'm not a monster. I'm a protector. I fight monsters.
I have been shown what you will be, Baron. You have no choice in the matter. You will put your beliefs aside to advance the greater good. You will become what you hate to achieve lasting peace and security for your people. And after you do this vile deed, history will understand and forgive you. History is written by the survivors and rewritten by their offspring. They will call you a military genius and hail you as the glorious savior of your land. A leader with the courage and the vision to decisively act and thereby change the fate of this barony forever. If you do not act, Baron Haldane, be assured that Malash will. What you so dread doing to others will be done to you and yours. Nueva Ville will become a graveyard. This barony will be turned to dust and scattered to the winds.
With those awful words ringing in his ears, Haldane staggered out of the hut. Though fumble-fingered from the fumes he'd inhaled, he managed to scoop up the Remington 1100. He caught himself as he reached to push aside the holdout blanket once more. He wanted nothing more than to blow the Oracle apart with high brass buckshot. But in his heart, he knew that killing the messenger wouldn't do any good. And knowing that the evil he was about to unleash was preordained and couldn't be avoided, did nothing to lighten the weight that lay upon his heart. While Ryan stood dripping on the edge of the riverbank, Malosh the Impaler leaned over in the saddle to give his prisoner a closer inspection. On either side of the masked Baron, a dozen swampies dug in their heels, fighting to restrain more of the massive dogs by their choke chains. Fanned out behind the stumpy muties were normal-sized Sekhmen carrying lanterns and pre-dark Comblock auto rifles. Ryan's thought, first and foremost, was getting his companions and himself out of this predicament alive. To have any hope of success against such long odds, they had to wait for their chance and work as a team. At that moment, it was unclear whether Malosh was going to let the companions live long enough to do that. After all, they had taken out a number of his valuable fighters. Slaughtering the guilty parties where they stood would have certainly evened the score. Ryan decided to play a hunch. He figured the Baron wasn't just looking for cannon fodder. To win battles, he needed hard-nosed, seasoned warriors. Courage in the face of death was the only hole card Ryan held.
Didn't your mama teach you it's rude to stare?
My mama was a gaudy house slut. To my knowledge, she never refused service to man or woman, nor more muty. She took on her customers three at a time and gave everyone his or her money's worth. The only thing my whore of a mother ever taught me was to get the jack up front.
Sound advice.
You know, I was just about to let my hunting dogs tear you limb from limb. But now I see they'd choke on those brass balls of yours. A man like you will serve me much better in one piece.
The Baron waved his Sekhmen forward.
Take them all back to the vill.
Malosh's men were an odd collection of humanity and near humanity. The Norm men and women were mostly in their late teens to late 20s. The Swampies weren't the only nuke-spawned horrors in the crowd, but the other muties weren't from distinct subhuman species. Ryan saw no stickies among the ranks, but that was no surprise. Stickies didn't do well in a military setting. Unlike swampies, they were creatures of uncontrollable urges. Sandwiched between Norms, muties, and dogs, the companions and a pair of swineherds trudged back along the high bank. They were marched down the same narrow alley they had exited. Ryan had carefully measured their escorts over the course of the return trip. Malosh's Sekhmen were professionals. That didn't bode well for a future escape. The Sekhmen led them to the vill's puddled central square, where the air hung heavy with the sour smell of drowned wood smoke and burned flesh. All of Redbone's shell-shocked survivors had been assembled there at Blaster Point. About 60 men and women and 20 children stood before three 15-foot-high posts that had been raised in front of the vill's stone-rimmed well. Threaded onto the tops of each of the debarked tree trunks were two naked men and a naked woman. All were dead.
Dark night. That's a nasty way to go.
Barbarous. It would appear that we have been tossed back into the Dark Ages.
What makes you think we ever left them?
Baron Malosh paced his chestnut horse back and forth in front of the displayed corpses. When the last of his men had entered the square, he reined in the stallion. Reaching down behind his knee, he unscabbarded a Kalashnikov assault rifle and aimed it at the sky. A handful of Redbone survivors looked up at the Baron with desperate dread. The rest looked only at their boot tops.
I'm offering you Redbone folk a choice. Join my army and fight beside me. It's a hard and dangerous life, but it's profitable too. There's booty to be had and plenty of food to eat. Join me willingly and share in the spoils of war, or I will make scarecrows out of you. Form a line, then. Do it now!
As his mercenaries jabbed and shoved the outnumbered captives into a ragged column, he dismounted, handing the reins to a swampy. The companions closed ranks, with Christy and Jack in front, the swineherds next, then Doc, JB, Mildred, and Ryan. Malosh took only a moment to size up the first person before impatiently waving him to the right, where soldiers waited. The fit-looking young man moved off, presumably to join the fighters. Malosh sent the able-bodied young to the right, the middle-aged but still mobile to the left, along with the older children. The elderly and the children under the age of 7, he waved back to the doorways of the ramshackle huts. The Baron started to wave Christy to the right, toward the Norm warriors, but caught himself. He bent closer and examined the springy coils of her red hair. When he reached out, the prehensile tendrils wriggled away from his touch.
You hide your rad-tainted blood well. You almost passed for Norm.
Of course, almost doesn't count. Join your fellow muties.
Christy didn't argue with the Baron. She wasn't ashamed of her heritage. She walked by him with her head held high. Malosh took one look at Jack's dead white skin and ruby red eyes.
You too, mutie.
Not a mutie.
And my mother wasn't a two-bit whore.
I'm a purebred albino.
The Baron wasn't interested in a genealogical debate. He was the sole arbiter of genetic purity. He gestured with his thumb again.
That way, mutie boy, or you croak on a spike.
Jack didn't budge a millimeter. In the Deathlands, being branded a mutie was the worst insult imaginable.
Pride goeth before a fall.
Misplaced pride in this case.
Dark Knight, what's Jack doing? He's not careful, he's gonna get himself chilled.
Come on, Jack. Come over here. Don't do this. Don't die for nothing.
Better listen to your long-legged friend there. She's trying to save your ass.
As distasteful as this particular sacrifice was, Jack turned without another word and started walking toward Christy and the squad of genetic misfits. Why Malosh was isolating the mutie element was obvious. Norms wouldn't fight alongside muties because they distrusted and feared them. For the same reasons, muties didn't like taking their marching orders from norms. As it turned out, Krad and Bezoar didn't pass Malosh's muster either. They were too slow of brain and foot, respectively. The Baron ordered the pair over with the cannon fodder. When Doc stepped up next, ebony walking stick in hand, Malosh immediately pointed him in the opposite direction.
Go back to the huts!
The huts? You have made a grave error, sir.
No mistake, old man. You belong with the other doddering geezers and the babies.
I assure you, sir, I am not ready for a rocking chair.
Doc drew the rapier blade of his sword stick, and with its razor point, cut a wicked S in the air an inch from the Baron's face. Before he could retract it, in a blur almost too fast to follow, Malosh grabbed hold of the blade, trapping it in his fist. Doc threw his full weight against the Baron's grip, but couldn't pull the rapier free or make its edge slice through the man's hand.
Kevlar glove.
When Malosh suddenly let go, Doc fell off balance.
Follow the Dimmy and the Gimp. You just signed your own death warrant, old man.
Ryan watched stoically as the Baron consigned Mildred and JB to the Norm fighters. But deep down, his guts were churning. With a companion split up among the three separate units, their chances of success looked even more bleak. As Ryan stepped forward, Malosh looked him straight in the eye.
From the way you stare at me with that blue peeper of yours, I'd say you're a cold heart, chill for pay man, a mercy by trade. If you serve me well, Mercy, I guarantee you will prosper. If you betray me, I will hunt you down and chill you triple ugly. But I'm wasting my breath, right? Dying hard doesn't scare a man like you, does it?
Fear only moves folks so far, and it can push from more than one direction. Once you get this kidnapped crew into battle, you lose your monopoly on death threats. What makes you think you could count on me or any of the others when the lead starts flying?
The joy of doing unto others as was done unto you. It's what makes the world go round.
Under the gruesome banner of its hoisted dead, Red Moonville was sacked to the bare walls. Malosh's army mainly supervised the work. Under its guns, the Villfolk were forced to loot their own homes. They sorted and piled their worldly goods in the square. Ammunition, weapons, cookware, and trade items. The hilltop town's food caches were also plundered, yielding up bags of grain, beans, potatoes, smoked joints of meat, and barrels of sweet water. This booty was packed into carts drawn by liberated horses and mules. As always, the Muti contingent got the brown end of the stick. Christy, Jack, the Betumored, the Extra-Limbed, and the Swampies were given the task of searching the knot of still-smoldering huts where Redbone fighters had made their last stand. The Swampies attacked the job with great enthusiasm. Like a pack of tailless rats, the Swampies rooted through the collapsed structures, pulling aside charred rafters, crawling on hands and knees into small, extremely hot spaces. For them, it was a treasure hunt. As the Swampies moved on to the next hut, Christy and Jack carefully made their way through the burned-out ruin to where a body lay. Christy knelt and started to pull off the man's boots. There were no laces. They came off easily. There were no socks underneath. Jack pulled up the hem of the rough shirt, exposing a pasty, flabby belly.
He's still alive.
The man opened his eyelids. His eyes bulged from a face blackened by soot, the whites, by contrast, shocking the brilliant.
Don't get up. Lie still. For Gaia's sake, play dead.
The Swampies in the neighboring ruin turned at the commotion. Jack leaned on the man's shoulders with both hands, trying to pin him down and hold him still.
Jack, look out!
A short, heavy blade flashed down, and the albino reacted, twisting out of the way. The Predark hatchet smashed the burned man in the middle of the forehead. Christy just managed to get a hand up in front of her face to block the flying brains and blood.
You don't have to play at nothing now.
The hatchet-wielding Chief Swampy put a boot on the man's lifeless face and wrenched the short handle back and forth, levering the axe head free from the bone. The boss Swampy called himself Meconium. Like other members of his kind, he had masses of tiny wrinkles around his eyes and a broad, flat nose. His coarse hands and feet were huge relative to his height. Even though he was only about 4'6", he weighed close to 175 pounds. Meconium looked like he was built from a short stack of cinder blocks. He grinned at Jack as he hefted the bloody hatchet. Sensing some big fun in the offing, the other Swampies stopped raking through the debris and circled around. None of them carried guns. The Barons didn't trust them with anything more lethal than edged weapons, nail-studded wooden clubs, and, of course, the Hellhounds, which were now chained in the square.
You ever take a look in a mirror, Snowball? Only a blind man could think you were Norm. Tell the truth, how did you come to be so white all over with those nasty red eyes? Did some scab-ass muty plow your ma's honeypot? Or did she come naturally with six tits and a chin beard?
Not a muty.
Acting like he had purer blood than the Swampies was a very bad move, in Christie's opinion. But that was Jack all over. She could understand why he was so damned adamant about his genetics. The muty brand had ugly consequences. Mutated species were at the bottom of Hellscape's pecking order, hunted down and chilled for sport by Norms, who are turned into slaves by them, and routinely worked to death.
Here's something for you.
Meconium immediately flicked away his jacket's boutonniere of mucus.
You're dead meat, Snowball!
Step back, Meconium.
Enough squabbling! Get back to work!
Unlike the Swampies, this normal-sized muty carried firearms. A long-barreled centerfire revolver hung in a pancake holster on his hip, and he held a battle-worn 12-gauge pump braced at waist height, the barrel squarely leveled at Meconium's bristling chin. Below his sweat-stained ball cap was a tumorous growth the color and size of a ripe eggplant. It stretched the skin on the right side of his face balloon-tight and balloon-shiny. The growth completely hid his right ear. Korb was Malash's appointed captain of the entire muty crew. The Swampies followed his orders and sullenly retreated. They resumed rummaging through the ash pit next door.
Better steer clear of them ball biters, boy. They pack fight like dogs. A gang up on you, first chance they get.
Apparently, Korb didn't hold a grudge against Jack for three times denying a muty birthright. He pointed at the distorted side of his own face.
You know, I cut this blasted thing off me once with a red-hot knife blade. After it was gone, I figured it'd leave a triple mean scar, but maybe I could pass for a wounded Norm. Well, I almost bled to death from sawing it off, and then the rad bastard grew back twice as big in a month.
As Korb walked away, Christy and Jack began stripping the dead man. After making a pile of the recyclable clothes, they carried his naked corpse by hands and feet to the cliff, and tossed him over the edge like a sack of garbage.
Hey! Over here, Snowball! We got another prize for you.
As the Swampies moved to the adjoining hut, Christy and Jack climbed over a tumble-down wall. The dwelling's opposite wall stood more or less intact. It supported a shaky latticework of burned and broken roof beams that juttered overhead. They couldn't miss the still form in the middle of the hut floor. Jack walked to the far side of the body. Suddenly, a long dark shadow dropped from above. A section of scorched beam caught Christy full across the shoulders, driving her to the ground. Even as the beam's weight slammed her face first into the ash, a Swampy jumped down on top of it. Her arms pinned under her body, Christy couldn't reach her weapon. She could barely draw breath with 175 pounds of muty sitting on the rafter on her back. The muty drew a machete to the side of her throat. Its edge bit into her skin. Trapped there, Christy realized the sneaky, Swampy bastards had set up the deadfall while she and Jack were disposing of the last corpse. In a matter of seconds, she had been taken out of the fight. As Jack came to her aid, drawing his .357 from its holster, Aconium hit him from behind with a charred piece of wood that shattered against the back of his head. If the makeshift club hadn't been burned through, the blow would have killed him stone dead. But Aconium didn't want him to die quickly. He wanted his crew to get in their licks first. Even though the blunt instrument failed, the force of the blow drove Jack to his knees and sent the cold python flying out of his hand and into the mound of wet ash beside the body. Jack sprang up and faced his attackers. The five swampies had their clubs and blades out. Even the one woman outweighed Jack by 80 or 90 pounds, but he towered over all of them.
We're gonna bust you up good. Then we're gonna hack you into bite-sized pieces.
Don't yell for help, Snowball.
You neither.
Christy expected leaf-bladed knives to start dropping out of his sleeves and fly through the air. At close range, Jack was a dead shot with blades. But no razor-sharp steel appeared in his palms. The albino had unconditionally accepted the terms of the fight. As much as the swampies wanted to hurt him, Jack wanted to hurt them. He intended to teach a final agonizing lesson before he dispatched his enemies. Jack feinted right, then darted left, punctuating a 360 spin move with a blur of a backhanded fist. The full power strike caught the nearest swampy in the middle of the face. Blood gushed from the broken nose, and the eyelids momentarily fluttered shut, but the block-like head didn't move. As the others closed in for the kill, Jack scampered as light as a spider over a jumble of scorched and overturned wooden furniture to the back of a fallen beam. The rafter lay at a 30-degree angle, with one end on the dirt floor, the other resting atop the far wall. Like an Olympic gymnast, Jack balanced effortlessly on the 6-inch-wide beam. Hoping to avoid the sideways slash of a short sword, he snap-kicked the stumpy swordsman under the chin. It had as much effect as kicking a boulder. Jack reached up with both hands, caught the end of a loose overhead beam, and hauled on it with his entire weight, making it pivot and swing down. As the swordsman lunged with his sword, the crossmember landed between his eyes. Determined to help her companion, Christy tried to push up from the floor. As she did, the edge of the machete scraped deeper into her neck. The swampy put his boot sole on top of her head and firmly shoved her face back into the ash. At that moment, Christy could have closed her eyes and summoned her Gaia power, the muti connection with the Earth spirit that gave her superhuman strength for brief periods of time. She could have used the Gaia energy to throw off both the beam and the swampy, but the aftermath of that psychic connection would have left her too drained to be of any use in a fight. When she looked up again, Jack was running full tilt along the top of the tumble-down wall. The swampies threw themselves at him, lunging with their weapons, trying to cut his legs out from under him. The higher Jack climbed along the wall, the less effective the swampies were. They couldn't jump for beans. Jack could have easily gotten away by dashing across the tops of the exposed rafters, but escape wasn't on his agenda. Instead, he leapt from the wall, over the swampies' heads, landing behind them. Before they could recover, Jack lashed out with a sidekick. It caught the swampy in front of him below the left ear, bouncing his forehead off the mud wall. Then the others attacked all at once. While Jack danced and dervished, a white whirlwind in their midst, the swampy seemed to be moving in slow motion. He ducked and dodged their rain of blows. They absorbed his like stumpy punching bags. With fists and feet, Jack pulped their faces, splitting their brows, closing their eyes, breaking out their yellow teeth. His knuckles and boots were smeared with blood and ash.
Help us get the bastard!
The crushing weight on Christie's back suddenly eased as the mutie jumped up and threw himself and his machete into the melee. Christy crawled out from under the beam with difficulty. As she drew her gun, the battle spilled out of the hut and rolled down the alley in the direction of the square. When the skirmish burst into view, Mildred was helping JB and Ryan strap water barrels onto a wooden-wheeled mule cart. Four swampies chased Jack out of the alley, waving their blades and clubs. The Sekmen raised their auto rifles, aiming not at the newcomers, but at the edges of the crowd. This to keep a wider battle from breaking out. Jack turned and attacked the swampies. Jack attacks, feet and fists found their targets over and over again, smashing into already bruised and bloodied faces. Nobody had never seen them fight with such savage frenzy. The systematic beating and the victim's inability to return any punishment took its toll. The sword and club strikes began to miss Jack, not by inches, but by feet. As the muties weakened, Jack isolated one of their number for special treatment. Pivoting as the Swampy swung his hatchet, Jack slipped behind the bastard and clapped a forearm across his throat, seizing hold of his left shoulder. He yanked off the Swampy's red stocking cap and snatched a handful of coarse brown hair.
No, Jack! You'll never break that neck!
That wasn't what Jack had in mind. He shook a leaf-bladed knife from the sleeve of the arm that pinned the mutie's chest, then jabbed one of the razor-sharp edges against the base of the hairy throat.
Time to die.
Just then, Korb stepped behind Jack and shouldered a pump shotgun, taking aim at the back of his skull.
If you chill that Swampy, Korb will blow your head off. This is my army. You follow my orders. You fight when I tell you to. Until then, you stand down, Mutie.
Not a Mutie!
The edge of the knife drew a fine red line across the exposed throat. It was a shallow wound, and only a couple of inches long, but it made blood spill over the Swampy's madly bobbing Adam's apple. Jack pressed the blade below the hinge of the Swampy's jaw, poised to cut much, much deeper, and from ear to ear.
Nuke in hell!
At that moment, the expression on the Swampy's face changed from incoherent fury to abject terror. He was certain he was going to die in the next few seconds.
Let go of that Swampy. I'm gonna count to three. One. Two.
Jack shoved the Swampy away from him. The Baron advanced on the tumor head, holding the shotgun.
If you let trouble like this break out again, Korb, you're the one who's gonna suffer.
Christie stepped from the crowd and handed Jack his Colt Python.
Move it, you two.
The two companions were ushered back down the alley. Jack walked with his back straight and his head high, having defended the purity of his genetics. After all the wags were loaded, Malash had his troops line up, the Redbone conscripts. The masked Baron then walked down the row and quickly selected three healthy young men and three healthy young women at random.
You six will stay behind. I've left you enough food and water to survive. As you rebuild your vill, remember my mercy.
While the lucky half-dozen hurried to join the very old and very young at the doorways of the empty huts, the Baron mounted his horse.
Move out!
Only Malash's officers rode, either on horseback or in the carts. Everyone else walked down the zigzag path to the fields below. The column of nearly 300 was a large force by Deathland standards, and it was segregated by genetics and military function.
Where the rad blazes are we headed?
Sunspotville. It's a long march due south. At least 2, maybe 3 days.
Well, what happens when we get there?
We take the vill, or die trying.
Baron Kendrick Haldane approached his Riverside compound. Parked in the lane in front of the side-by-side, double-wide trailers that housed his residence and administrative offices was a convoy of armored pre-dark wags, Hummers, Winnebago Braves. One of the vehicles, a veritable landship with a skin of gunmetal gray steel plate, dwarfed all the others. The metal windshield had 2 wide rows of louvered view slits for the driver and navigator. Bulletproof skirts protected the 3 sets of wheels. Amidships and rear, the wheels were doubled. On the roof, fore and aft, heavy, swivel-mounted machine guns controlled 360 degrees of terrain. The Baron had positioned his Ville defense force in the surrounding buildings, ditches, and fields. From these hiding places, they aimed 2 old RPGs that had been acquired by the old Baron at the parked vehicles and the seated men, ensuring that any attempt at a double-cross would end as quickly as it started. A grenade attack turning wags into burning hulks and men into dismembered corpses in a matter of seconds. The crew members and sec teams that were not eating were busy drinking green beer from recycled antifreeze jugs and smoking hand-rolled cigarettes. Their pre-dark mil-spec weapons were prominently displayed. The 9mm Heckler & Koch MP5 A3 submachine guns looked brand new. The visitors didn't rise in deference or salute as Haldane passed. Some ignored him. Most stared with unconcealed contempt. They had no fear of him. Or perhaps they had a far greater fear of their employer. The sec men and drivers were uniformly large, tall, well-fed, and muscular. ground in dirt, caked their hands and faces and the sides of their heavy black boots. Haldane entered the big wag via a porthole door amidships. The narrow metal corridor was dim and filled with the most horrible smell, a slaughterhouse in July. To the right, down the accessway, a sec man with shoulder-length blonde dreadlocks motioned impatiently for him to approach.
Did you talk to your god?
The guard held the muzzle of his H&K pointed at the Baron's bowels, his finger resting lightly on the trigger.
No, my god talked to me through his chosen oracle.
Ain't but one true god in Deathlands, Baron, and he's waiting for you back there.
The sec man hooked a thumb over his shoulder in the direction of the wag's rear salon. As Haldane started to walk past, the sentry put out his free hand.
Give me that blaster.
The Baron let him take the Remington, then started down the hall. On his right were evenly spaced firing ports and view slits. On his left were riveted metal walls and closed metal doors. Haldane sprinted for the door. The lamp-lit workbenches and tables that choked the middle of the room were cluttered with surgical tools, rusting cans, and piles of rags. Under the tables were buckets of what looked like dirty transmission fluid. Floor-to-ceiling metal shelves overflowed with electronic and computer parts. In front of a double ceramic sink was a 55-gallon plastic barrel in which floated human body parts. The concentrated reek of abattoir made the Baron's eyes water and his gorge rise. In the gloom on the far side of the jumble of tables, something moved on the broad rear bench. In a full moon of festering flesh set eyes like chromed hen's eggs, an ancient, unblinking evil. When Haldane moved closer, he saw the small, blonde-haired child sitting ever so still on the creature's lap. It was the Baron's son, Thorn. The boy's blue eyes wore an expression he had never seen before and never wanted to see again. Thorn was paralyzed with terror. A half-metal, half-human claw rested easily on the back of the boy's slender neck.
You have a very inquisitive child here, Baron. He asked me for a guided tour of my war wag. I think I have satisfied his curiosity.
Thorn Haldane looked up at his father, desperate to be away, but afraid to move a muscle. As adrenaline flooded the Baron's veins, a mechanized hand slipped down to cover the center of the child's chest.
He has such a strong little heart.
Come here, son.
Magus held the boy fast on his lap, and the Baron sensed the creature's insane jealousy, his envy of the budding young life. Haldane had a 9-inch killing dirk concealed up his sleeve. But where to stab? Which of the rat's nest of plastic tubes and colorful wires to cut? And failing a one-strike instant kill, those metal fingers would crush his child's head. The dirk remained in its sheath.
Son, come to me. You have no business here.
Magus didn't try to stop the boy as he cautiously slipped off his lap. Thorn hurried between the tables to hide behind his father's stout legs. Magus's metal eyes dilated. It was said, and widely believed, that this monstrous, suppurating creature experimented with the organs of other people in order to find ways to improve his own ability to function. It was said that Magus was so removed from his human origins that he performed operations on himself. He could turn off his pain centers and yank out and replace his own innards like components of a wag engine. There would be no experiments on Haldane's only son. Not while the Baron still drew breath. Without a word, he picked up the boy and turned to leave. He carried him down the hall, past the grinning sec man, to the porthole door.
They grabbed me and brought me in here, Daddy. I didn't want to see this place.
I know you didn't. It's okay now.
Haldane put the child down.
Run, Thorn. Run!
The boy jumped to the ground and took off down the lane like a shot through the first spattering of rain. As Haldane turned back for the salon, his hands began to tremble and shake. This was how Magus took and maintained control of even the strongest, the bravest of men. This was how he corrupted them. He showed them their most terrible fear and that he had the power to make it come to pass. The creature called Steel Eyes dealt in weapons of mass destruction, the deadliest instruments that civilization had ever produced. He didn't aspire to baronhood, but he pulled strings behind the scenes like a puppet master, applying pressure here, pressure there, for motives that were unfathomable. The Baron re-entered the salon and stepped right up to Magus, close enough to see the inflamed joints of live flesh and polished metal. Through the rear window's view slits, in down-slanting shafts of light, fat flies buzzed and zigzagged.
You shouldn't have touched my son.
I did him no harm. I'm not contagious. It was an educational experience for him. He saw the greatest miracle of Whitecoat science at close range.
Before we proceed, I want assurance that the loss of life will be confined.
Oh, I never give guarantees. The weapon systems I have brought you are indiscriminate by design. As we speak, the Impaler is advancing on Sunspot with a large military force. He will rout your small detachment of fighters, take over the Ville, and re-establish his staging point for another hit-and-run attack on Nuevaville. Yes or no, Haldane?
The puppet master understood the trap in which Haldane and his archenemy were caught. Both controlled minor fiefdoms with small populations and large, mostly uninhabitable territories. Melash wanted the natural resources of Haldane's barony. Haldane wanted to protect them. Haldane couldn't defeat Melash's mobile army. Melash couldn't defeat Haldane's hardened defenses. For years, control of Sunspot had swung back and forth between the adversaries, with the Ville folk caught in the middle. Haldane saw the fighting and the loss of life as a waste of precious resources and time. The constant conflict kept him from developing economic relationships with the wealthy eastern baronies, from building new trade routes, from bringing more prosperity to his people. It kept him from giving them a future. Magus had appeared on his doorstep with a long-term solution to the problem. The only way to end the stalemate was to obliterate Sunspotville and make it useless to either side. For some to live, others had to die. The price of peace was mass murder.
Show me what you brought.
Magus lurched from the bench seat with speed and agility that surprised Haldane. He whipped aside a tarp on the floor, exposing a pair of lidless crates. Inside one, in neat rows, were point-nosed artillery projectiles. The second crate held cased propellant charges. Like the WAG crew's H&Ks, it all looked brand new.
The chem weapon warheads are fired by the Soviet Lyugushka D-30 122mm howitzer. Its maximum range is a little more than 9 miles.
And you have this gun?
Of course. Is safely hidden between here and the proposed target.
There are two kinds of shells in the crate.
That's right. You have a choice to make, Baron. Would you prefer nerve or blister gas?